You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm going to hand you over to someone who is a staple person on our Greenbelt schedule, our programme every year. We are so thrilled to have him. John, already I heard applause. John Bell is a hymn writer, a worship leader, has been a prominent, and still is a prominent figure in the Iona community, and was a resource worker for 40 years. As I said, his talks have become a really highlight for so many Greenbelters over the years, and I am sure that this year will be absolutely no different. So prepare your minds and your faces and your hair, remember photos. And this is Elephants and Porcupines with Reverend John Bell.
I want to make an announcement now, which is that this is the last time in which I'm going to be a main speaker here. No. By my choice. It's not because I've been given a P40, although I've waited for that for a long while. But I think that when you have lived for 3/4 of a century, it's incumbent on you to let go of some of the things, even of which you are fond, so that people who are younger than you know that you can retire quite gracefully and not wait, in my case, until I become the kind of Rod Stewart of Greenbelt. So I may well come back in a lesser capacity, but this is the last time I'll speak as a main speaker. And I want to dedicate this, it's a talk today, to Cathy Galloway, who was for a long time the leader of the Iona community, who was leader of Christian Aid in Scotland, who's one of the most significant Christian women born in Scotland in the 20th century. She is now in palliative care in a hospital in Glasgow. She's nearing the beginning of her last journey. I saw her for the last 2 weeks just before I came here, and I had an email from her, or a text message from her children this morning, saying that she's probably coming towards her end. So, a great witness to the faith. I'm beginning with a story, and it's a once upon a time story. Once upon a time, the trees decided that they would anoint a king to rule over them. And they said to the olive tree, "Will you be our king?" And the olive tree said, "Why should I give up producing oil, which people enjoy, just to be a king?" So they then went to the fig tree and they said, "Will you come and be our king?" And the fig tree said, "No, because I enjoy making fruit, which other people enjoy eating. Why should I want to become the king?" And then they said to the vine, "Will you be the king over us?" And the vine said, "Certainly not. I produce wine and I'm very happy to continue doing that. Why should I give up making wine just to become the controller of other trees?" And then the trees said to the thorn bush, "Will you be our king?" And the thorn bush replied, if you want to anoint me as king, come and shelter under my protection. If you don't, I'll set fire to you and every other tree in the vicinity." Now, if this were a smaller group, I'd ask you to turn to each other and say, what's that about? I did that about 3 months ago with a retreat in Iona, and almost immediately, two women said, "The great leader." The background to this story, it comes from the Bible, is that Gideon was a great warrior who killed thousands of people, and he had 70 sons and probably the same number of daughters, but maybe not quite so many wives. And he decided that when he was coming to his end and he was going to cease to be the sole ruler over Israel, that it would be his 70 sons who would take over the job. Now, how they managed that, I have no idea. Whether they divided it into 7 justiciaries or 70 different areas of concern, I don't know. But he had, as well as 70 legitimate sons, he had an illegitimate sons whose name was, and there's two ways of pronouncing this, either Abimelech or Abimelech. So choose which one you want. And Abimelech was the son of his concubine, who was severely grieved that his stepbrothers should all have some responsibility to rule over Israel, and he was having nothing given to him at all. So he spoke to his mother and to the friends who were around him, who were favourable to him, and he said to them, look, what's better, to have 70 idiots trying to control the country or to have one person who knows exactly how things should happen? And of course, he was pointing modestly to himself. And so they put together, those who were favourable to him, enough money to hire killers who killed the 70 sons of Gideon, all apart from one, who was called Jotham. And Jotham, having escaped assassination, went up a high hill, and he told the parable, which I mentioned earlier. So I'm going to read it again, and then to see its relevance to today. Once upon a time, the trees decided to anoint a king to rule over them. They said to the olive tree, come and be our king. The olive tree answered, what? Have I to stop producing rich oil, which benefits gods and humanity, just to hold authority over the other trees? So they said to the fig tree, come and be our king. And the fig tree answered, what? I produce delicious fruit, which everyone enjoys. I don't want to be your ruler. Then they said to the vine, will you be the king over us? And the vine answered, why should I stop producing wine which cheers the hearts of everyone who drinks it in order to be king? Then the trees said to the thorn bush, would you consider being king? And the thorn bush answered, if you want to anoint me as king, come and shelter under my protection. If you don't, I'll set fire to you and every other tree in the vicinity. Now, if you examine this story carefully, it comes from the book of Judges, you'll see parallels between Abimelech and a significant number of present or former heads of state, as well as the great leader. And here are some of the similarities. The olive, the fig, and the vine have plenty to offer voluntarily, which benefits others. These trees work for the good of humanity. The thorn only wants power over the others. Secondly, the thorn also believes that he and he only is fit to rule and is prepared, chosen or not, to annihilate opposition. Thirdly, the thorn is highly self-opinionated, narcissistic, and overdoses on entitlement and the mere thought of being in charge. Fourthly, the thorn plays the victim card. This is very important, for not only does the thorn suggest that he's being victimized, he suggests that those around him are also being victimized. This is the classic means to gain and secure power exhibited in bold relief by Hitler. The great leader in the country I'll call Asu is very fond of making out that he is the victim of the opposition party, of people within his own sector who disagree with him, of nations which are unfavourable, particularly China, towards USA, ASU. And he encourages the people of ASU to believe that they are the victims. And this is a highly pernicious thing. If you make out that you're being victimised and you know that they are being victimised, then there is a malevolence which can accrue, which is highly detrimental to the well-being of the nation. And fifthly, though not in the biblical text, but evident in the lives of contemporary despots, there is not one woman in the close inner circle who wields influence. Consider the great leader and his fellow dictators, Putin, Kim Jong-un, Orbán, Xi, Bolsonaro as was, Maduro as is Netanyahu. A repugnant coterie of self-obsessed despots, bringing with toxic masculinity and often with no scintilla of empathy, that has been driven out by their egos. And as long as such people, all of whom are self-publicists, retain the interests of the press and social media, they effectively demonstrate what toxic masculinity can do and provide role models for angry and aggrieved young males who emulate their arrogance by going on the rampage. If you look or consider the kind of social disturbances which have been happening from the right and the left since last year at Southport, you see people who have been convinced that they are the victims, that people are against them, and they do what toxic masculinity encourages them to do. Now, why does the great leader use his imperium to sack officials in political and civic institutions and demand changes to university syllabi? Why does the great leader regard making a deal more important than exercising diplomacy? Why does the great leader exercise or enact legislation which will lead to certain death in other parts of the world? I think particularly of sub-Saharan Africa, where a number of nations were dependent on the generosity of ASU aid to sustain health programs. They are now abandoned, which will most certainly lead to the death of children and adults, particularly those with HIV/AIDS dependent on antiretrovirals. I say this with some conviction because last week a friend of mine called Maxwell, who lives in Zimbabwe, wrote about the effect that the great leader's administration was having on his country. He depends, or has depended, on life-saving vaccines for the past 15 years and now has been told by the health ministry that they will no longer be available. And he regards what has happened as one of the worst acts of genocide, which has a global effect, all because of the bullying of a big brother-like creature. Why does the great leader and others substitute lies for truth unashamedly? Why does the great leader see his nation as a rival and more important than the United Nations? And why do so many people support him? Now, I don't have an answer to all these enigmas, but I was alerted this year, earlier, by a letter which came from a woman I haven't seen for a while. I don't know her all that well. I know her son better. He studied at St Andrews University. This woman lives in ASU, and she's a spiritual director. And she deals particularly with priests and pastors. And she wrote to say, "I feel totally hopeless. I do not know what to say to these people who feel that the way their nation is going is in a retrograde direction, but do not know what to say for fear of losing half their congregations." And it dawned on me as a visitor to ASU for the last 40 years, for most years in the last 40, it dawned on me that I have never been in a conversation where people from different political backgrounds have been talking together about a contentious subject, whether that's women's reproductive rights, or whether it might be LGBTQ issues, or whether it might be immigrants. If all the people from one party are together, then they will talk about the issue. If all the people from the other party, or those in that community, are together, they will talk about the contentious issue. But you never find a group of people sitting together who will cross the political divides and try to come to an understanding of why different people believe different things. Now, this was brought out in great profile about, it would be 10 years ago, when friends of mine, working colleagues, came from Asu to Scotland. And they had gone to the kind of medieval slum that we call Edinburgh for the morning. And in the evening, they were coming across to the city of culture. And we were having a conversation in the train. It was it's more than 10 years, because I remember, I think Blair was in government at that time. And the government of the day had enacted something which I didn't agree with. So there's a group of us all talking in this compartment about this particular issue. And my friend Michael, occasionally, he came into the conversation occasionally, but he was always talking very quietly. And I said to him, "Michael, why are you whispering?" And he said, "Well, we're talking about your Prime Minister." I said, "Yeah, but everybody does." And if you look around this compartment, there are people here who are conservative and who are socialist and who are Greens and who are nationalist and who are liberal and who might be communist. Oh, he said, "This would never happen in my country." That is the elephant in the room. That people in Asu will not sit together across the divide and come to some understanding or some common mind. But to be poles apart seems to be the preferred option. There were three Lutheran priests came to Iona about maybe 12 years ago, and we had a drink together. They were lovely men. And I said to them, "What is it that you wish for your congregations?" And after a while, they came to a common mind, and one said, "Well, I think we all agree that we wish that our congregations were places where people could talk about what makes for the common good." I said, "What does that mean?" And this guy said, "Well," he said, "if in my church council we have a conversation about, for example, it's time that we repainted the ladies' toilet, and someone will say, 'I propose that we paint it lime green,' and someone else will say, 'I propose we paint it pink.'" Now, these are not colour stylists. These are not people who are interior designers. But one belongs to one party in Asu, and the other another. And they have a proxy war over an issue of what colour you choose to paint the ladies' toilet. No wonder people in that nation feel slightly hopeless. And I suggest that at the present time, even within our own country, there's a sense of a lack of positiveness about the future. And I want to deal to some extent with that. But when I'm asked, as has frequently happened in recent months, "Give us some hope," or "Can you speak to us about hope?" I kind of retreat from that. I would rather say, "What is it that makes you feel so hopeless? And can you articulate that so that we can begin to deal with it?" Because unlike optimism, hope is a verb. It's not some kind of medication which is dispensed from somebody who has a lot of it. And to some extent, I don't believe that we can feel hope unless we're doing something which leads us to feel hopeful. You know, when I go to the doctors, I begin to feel hopeful about my health the moment I cross the door. Not the first thing that the doctor says, but the fact that I've made an effort to see which is wrong with me, then I begin to feel there's a possibility of some resolution. If you're ever, people of this audience remember probably Rubik's Cubes, which are coming back into fashion. You know, you look at a Rubik's Cube and you think, "I would never be able to make head nor tail of that." You look at it, but by looking at it, by admiring it, by taking a photograph of it, it doesn't get it into the order that you wish it. It's when you begin with your manual dexterity to begin to move things around that you feel there might be the chance that I solve this puzzle. So I want, in the face of what seems for some people to be kind of hopelessness, to suggest not the panacea, but a couple of things which in spiritual terms might help us. And one is that I believe, particularly those, I am three quarters of a century old, and I believe that people of my age and slightly younger have to be those who invest hope in younger people and who articulate that quite clearly. We should not bemoan the future which we are bestowing on young people without also expressing our deep hope in and trust in them to be able to do the things which we have been unable to do ourselves. That is the message of the Bible. Whether it be David against Goliath, whether it be the young boy who comes to put loaves and fishes into Jesus' hands, God calls out among younger people a potential which we have to endorse. Just 2 weeks ago, I was in Birmingham, and I had about an hour and a half between trains and the central station, so I went to Moor Street, which has two very nice cafes, and I went there just to have coffee. And I'm sitting reading a book, and opposite me is a young man, 25, black, and he sees the book I'm reading, and he says, "I quite like that title." I said, "Why?" He said, "I just quite like that title." He said, "You've got an accent." I said, "And you think you don't have an accent?" He says, "No, but I know where your accent comes from. You come from Glasgow." I said, "How do you know that?" He says, "I used to live in Glasgow." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, I did. And I know places like Kilmarnock and Ardrossan and Hamilton." I said, "Well, that's great." He said, "I did a degree there. Then I went to Aberdeen." I said, "Why the hell did you go to Aberdeen?" I said, "It's grey up there. It's cold up there." I said, "A whole lot of Africans go to Aberdeen. I don't understand that." He said, "Well, it was to do with oil, because it's the kind of centre of study, Robert Gordon's Institute, about oil." So I went there and I did my master's. Oh. And then I came back to England to do a PhD. I said, "Did you do your PhD in oil?" He said, No. I did it in climate change. He said, "In fact, my PhD is in how you enable carbon which has been captured to be turned safely into electricity." He said, I had a job back in Nigeria. My father's an oil man. But I learned about climate change and I thought, I cannot devote my life to a career which will damage the globe. I have to help to repair the globe. So I said, "Well, can you tell me, because I'm not a scientist, can you tell me just a little bit about what you're doing?" So in beautiful, clear tones, he told me what he was researching. And at the end of it, I could do nothing more than say, "What a magnificent thing you're doing with your life, that you've changed completely, that you're going to enable this world to survive. Well done." I said, "In fact, I think I should give you money for this seminar." He said, "If you gave me, I wouldn't receive it. But I'll tell you what, will you pray for me tomorrow? Because I'm going to ask my girlfriend to marry me." All the way from Nigeria, and in this country, he changes his mind. So that's one thing. And the second thing is that I believe that we have in our devotional life to be honest to God. You know, if somebody is battering the wife in the house next door to me, I don't pray, should it happen, that she will accept the blows and forgive her husband. I want to pray that somebody intervenes in this situation, the police come and arrest the guy, and she is relieved from that kind of oppression. So when we are confronted in the political sphere, in a global sphere, with that is pernicious, what is it that we pray? Now, if we don't have a vocabulary, then the Bible has a vocabulary. Because the Psalms are the record of a people who knew what oppression was and who sometimes were the oppressors. And from time to time, we have to draw into that. And if we are afraid to see these words, then lean on them, because Jesus knew them by heart. In Toronto 2 years ago, I was in a convent, and there was a woman there who was not in the retreat I was leading. And I got into conversation one day with her and I discovered she was Russian. And I said, so are you, what are you doing in Canada? She said, well, I'm Russian, as you hear, and I'm also a reporter. And I have friends who have been killed by the regime, and I have friends who are in prison. And I don't want to be imprisoned. So I've come here looking for sanctuary and hoping that Canada, for a while, will allow me to stay here. And she said, I've come to this convent, but I do not know what to pray. I hate Putin. I hate him with all my heart for what he's done for my country, and I don't know what to pray. So I said to her, well, I'm going to give you a copy of a psalm. It's Psalm 52, which Doug Gay, who's a friend of mine and a lecturer in Glasgow University, had worked on. The psalms are... The original language of the Psalms is very direct, it's very straightforward. When it's translated into English, sometimes they lose their kind of verve. And this is Doug's translation of Psalm 52. You cunning liar. Now that's what you normally don't expect, you know, at the beginning of a psalm. But this is what it's about. You cunning liar, why publicize your evil need to harm the good? Your slanderous tongue is razor sharp, honed to fulfill malicious plans. You love the lie and hate the truth. May God rise up to pull you down, uproot and sweep you far away. Then may the just look on aghast and mock the one who valued wealth, who trusted riches more than God. God, let me, like a spreading tree, grow as I trust in your sure love. Where loyal servants offer praise within your house, I'll add my voice to glorify your holy name. 2 days later, I bumped into the girl again, and she said, I've begun to pray again. The Magnificat has these lines in it where Mary speaks of how God is the one who will pull the mighty from their thrones and lift up the humble and the meek. I mean, if you go to Anglican Evensong, it sounds like a pleasure activity. But if you think of the Psalms, if the work of God is to pull down the mighty from their thrones and to lift up the humble and the meek, then we should feel confident in praying for that when you're confronted with despicable despotic powers. But what I really want to talk about, though these are important, is being subversive. Because this is an option which the Bible favours consistently. That when logic fails and argument fails, then be subversive. Now, it may be long enough ago for people to have forgotten this, but one Sunday morning at the morning communion, there was a depiction of what I regard as one of the funniest stories in the Bible, but also one of the greatest stories. And it involves initially two women. And it's right at the beginning of the book of Exodus, where the Jews have been, or the Hebrews at that time, as they were called, have been enslaved by the Egyptians. And the Pharaoh is worried that the Hebrew population might, outnumber the Egyptian population. They seem just to keep on conceiving and having children. And so he has to stop that. And the way he decides to stop it is to have a cull to cut down the number of male children. So he brings in to his establishment Shifra and Puah, who are two Hebrew midwives. And he says to them quite explicitly, now when you go to a Hebrew household to deliver a baby, if it's a girl, let her live. If it's a boy, kill him at birth. Because these are the ones who cause the trouble. If it's a boy, kill him at birth. So the Hebrew midwives bow and say, Your Majesty, and then leave his presence and don't bother at all for 3 or 4 years. And the old pharaoh's looking out the window one day and he sees all these wee Hebrew boys walking about who should be dead. So he calls them in and he says, Now, what's this? You know, 3 years. Oh, Shifra says, Your Majesty, you don't understand because you're just a man. You see, there's a great difference between being Hebrew women, our type, and Egyptian women, your type. You see, when Egyptian women go into labour, it lasts for about 3 days. Whereas with Hebrew women, it's just a huff and a puff, and out comes wee Elijah. And they hide him before we get to the door. And for being so subversive, God honours these women by giving them children of their own. Now, all through the Hebrew scriptures, there are similar stories where women are called by God to be subversive. And the reason why people don't know these stories is because they don't appear in the church lectionaries and they are not chosen by male priests or pastors. And if you want to know them in order of appearance, here are some: Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Tamar and Rahab and Jael and Ruth and Esther and the five daughters of Zelophehad. It sounds like, you know, a girl band. And you get it, I don't have the exact, I think it's somewhere at the end of the book of Numbers, where this man Zelophehad has died and he's got no sons. He's just got these five daughters. And of course at that time, daughters had no standing in the law. Women could not appear in court. They had no rights to do with, you know, civic legal provision or anything like that. So these five daughters are really quite aggrieved that their old man has died and that the law says that all their father's property shall be transferred to his brothers if there is no male heir. So they're looking at these uncles who might not be best pleased that they have to look after these five hapless girls who have sustained their father and kept his business going, but suddenly they're responsible for them. And the girls don't want to be dependent on their uncles. So they go up and they challenge Moses and they say to Moses, it's not fair. Our father didn't pray for daughters, we didn't ask to be girls, but it's the way it turned out. Why should we not inherit our father's property? So Moses, who's had a hard time, you know, if you read the prayer life of Moses, he constantly, at one point he says to God, am I their mother? Well, God's good at rhetorical questions, so there's no reply. But this time he goes to God and he says, I don't know what I'm going to do, God. I mean, these five girls, they're in my case morning, noon and night because their father's died and there's no male heir and their uncles are going to be responsible and they just won't go away. And God says, well, change the law. Now, this is 3,000 years before in Britain the law of property changed so that females could inherit their father's property. It wasn't until the 50s or 60s. The law which enabled the first female, the first child of the monarch to become the next monarch, whether that child was male or female, that wasn't enacted until the 21st century. But 3,000 years ago, five girls who had no place in the law and who should not have questioned their superiors were able to change it completely. What about old Paul? 2 Corinthians 1. Think what kind of people you are. Few of you are wise by any human standard, few powerful or of noble birth. Yet to shame the wise, God has chosen what the world counts foolishness. And to shame the strong, God has chosen what the world counts weakness. God has chosen things without rank or standing in the world, mere nothings, to overthrow the existing order. Cunning and gentle subversion are not condemned, but condoned by Jesus. He asks us to be as gentle as doves and to be as wary as serpents or wise as serpents. The dove option is what most people go for. It avoids controversy. But Jesus himself is subversive. Most of his parables, from the Good Samaritan to the Great Feast, are about the subversion of conformity. In them, the wrong people become the heroes, and conventional respectability is turned on its head. And increasingly, as people read the parables, not through the lens of European biblical scholars, but in the context of lived life, new insight into the power of these stories is revealed. Now, forgive me if you've heard this before. I suspect perhaps many have not. But if we look at the parable of the talents, this is the parable in which three men are given different amounts of money by an absentee landlord, and the first two invest it and give him a return for his money. The third is the one who buries the money in the ground because he knows that his master is a cruel man. Now, I have preached this and I've heard it preached as with regard to the talents in our life as well as our money and how we should not bury them, but we should, for the benefit of God's people and the future of God's kingdom, we should exploit them to the full and increase them. That's the good old Western reading. But elsewhere in the world, in sub-Saharan Africa and in Central America, people have another take on that. Because when they look at Jesus' parables about rich people, they are not always approving of those who make their wealth by stealth. And so for some people, this is a great parable of subversion. If you were the virtual slave of a rich landowner who brutalized his workers and amassed vast wealth for himself by, for example, exporting cocaine, and he gave you money to look after with the expectation that you would invest it on his behalf, would you, under God, increase his fortune, endorse his criminality, or would you refuse to engage with his profiteering, which caused misery in the world, even at the cost of your own security? Perhaps the parable is about refusing to increase the prestige or the wealth of those who have more than enough, at whatever the cost. Now, I could cite several contemporary examples of when be subversive has worked. And some on a, you know, a personal level. I travel a lot by train, and one of the things that annoys me is when I travel in the quiet compartment and somebody begins to speak on their mobile phone. And it was at Carlisle, after having travelled up in abject quietness from Euston, Carlisle, this lady got on Sunday evening, and she sits down not far from me, and she's on the phone. "Hello, is that you, John? Oh, well, good, I'm so glad I got you, because, you know, tomorrow we're going to have this meeting, and it's being chaired, yes, I know, by Charles, and his wife will be there." Now, you know what Charlie's like. They, between them, will have fixed up the whole damn agenda. And if that son of theirs, Edmund, is there, it's going to be even worse. And there's no chance that we'll be able to do what we know needs to be done. And I think we have to, I'm proposing that we meet for breakfast at 6:30 and we get the thing fixed before we go into the meeting. I said, "Excuse me, madam, I know exactly who you're speaking about." I had no idea who it was. but she very quickly tore into another compartment. Not the same. we had a man in the Iono community, he's dead now, lovely guy, called Eust, who, if, and Eust was not a conservative, but if, under, we had a prime minister at one time, I forget her name for the moment, but during her reign, He would frequently write to his local MP, who was a Tory, and to the relevant government minister about something which the lady in question was enacting. And he'd say, you know, I've thought of this, and I've talked to a lot of my friends in the party, and we're quite convinced that it'll not be good for the party if this proceeds. No, he never said what party it was. And he always got very polite and encouraging replies. We had another woman in the INO community called Sally, who was she was widowed, and Sally would be in her 80s. And she lived in her home, but she took in asylum seekers, whether legal or illegal. She looked after them in her house. And one day she was confronted with the authorities who came to her door and said, excuse me, madam, but we want to ask you, we've heard report that you are concealing an asylum seeker. And she said, what? We understand that you might be having an asylum seeker live in your house. And Sally said, listen, I am over 80. I am the widow of a Christian minister. What do you think I would be doing with an asylum seeker in my house? It's just pure subversion. And on a corporate level, and I don't say this with any disregard for my dear friends in this great and pleasant, green and pleasant land, but the abolition of the poll tax did not come because there were riots in Trafalgar Square, which there were, but because this tax, don't remember what it was a kind of egalitarian measure so that everybody would pay the same level of local taxation, which meant that a single person living in a house with 12 rooms and needing constant surveillance by the police paid the same amount as each of six adults who lived together in a damp council flat. It was so egalitarian. Well, it went because in Scotland we refused to pay it. Massive campaign. Defied the government. And eventually it was taken off the statute books. But I want to finish with a story about Betty Brown and Billy Black. Now, these are not the names of these people. And it's not the first time in this talk that I've disguised, but I cannot remember the names at all. I've deliberately forgotten them, because when I met the woman who I'm calling Betty Brown, she was a phenomenal woman. I was put in touch with her by her minister. And I once told this story in public before, and afterwards a reporter came up and wanted to find out where she lived, because he thought it was such a good story, it should be in the news. So I'm not. It happens in Asu, and more than that, I'm not prepared to tell. But essentially, Betty Brown was a student in a small university town in the south of Asu. And she and three other people who were her friends were quite interested in a local town meeting. They were at a small university, but they saw a local town meeting was about how there was going to be a proposal that the town allowed liquor licences. It was a southern town in which liquor licences were not very common, and in this particular county, there were not too many. But this town, somebody in it thought it would be good if we could have one, so we didn't have to go in a car to another town to buy beer or to buy wine. So a town meeting. And Billy Black, who was the president of the Board of Governors in the First Baptist, Southern Baptist Church, Board of Deacons in the First Baptist Church, he was a local lawyer and he was dead against this. And so Betty and her friends did a wee bit. They kind of roughly had heard about Black. He was a kind of local personality. They did a bit of background on him. And they went to the town meeting. And Black, being a lawyer and used to strutting about in front of a judge, did that on the platform in front of the gathered citizens and said what a despicable thing it was that drink causes misery, is something which is totally antithetical to good behaviour and to a happy environment. It's not something which should ever happen in this town. We've always been dry. We'll stay dry. And then somebody stood up who was in favour of having a licence allowed, and he sat down with little applause, and then questions were asked. And Betty stood up and said, yes, I would like to ask Mr. Black, why is it that you object to having a liquor licence for property in this town when you own liquor store licences in other towns in the state? And Black said, this is appalling. Where do these people come from? This is what happens. We get people who come from the north, they come to the south, they don't understand our community, they make all these vile suggestions. These people are communists. I insist that they are thrown out of this public meeting. Everybody applauded, they were thrown out. So they got in touch with a young lawyer and they said to him, we want to sue Black for defamation of character because we are studying law or accountancy. And if it is known, because it had been in the press, that these communists had infiltrated a town meeting and made accusations against Mr. Black, then that would not stand good for them in the future. And the young lawyer said, I know the accusations you made, I mean, they were in the paper. Do you have any proof? Well, they said, yeah, we have good proof. And they showed the evidence that he had liquor licences in three other towns. So the young lawyer went to Black's lawyer and said, I have a woman called Betty Brown and three of her colleagues, and they are taking out a defamation practice, a defamation article, whatever the hell you call it, against Mr. Black for defaming them in public. And Black's lawyer said, well, do you have any proof? And he said, yeah, we have quite substantial proof. And he showed them the documents. So the Black's lawyer took a photocopy, he went to Black and he said, yeah, they've got you. And Black said, what are they asking? He said, $2.5 million. And Black said, you're liable to get that down? He said, we could perhaps get it down to $2 million. Otherwise, if you want to, you know, take them on in court, then everything will come out. So Black said, okay, we'll go for a settlement. And his lawyer said, they'll go for $2 million. But they want to meet you first. Now, they had done some more work on Black, and they discovered that he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So when they met him, Betty said, Mr. Black, we're very grateful to you that you're willing to have a settlement with us for $2 million. But I want to tell you that we do not want any of your money. We won't take any of it. But we've got to love this small town. And we know that in the First Baptist Church, they've got this huge organ, which people come to listen to from all over the place. There's a Black Baptist church in which the organ isn't working. And we thought it'd be really good if there was the William Black organ for the... And we know that in that vicinity, in which there are quite a lot of African-American children play, the swing park is in disarray. And we thought that it would be really good if we could, you know, have a new swing park and, you know, permanent facilities for young Black kids to play, William Black Park for African American children. And we're here because our parents were wealthy enough to put us through university or because we won a scholarship. But we know that Black students never get into university here because they can't pay for it. So we reckon that these first two things might cost about $80,000, $90,000, maybe more, maybe $100,000. But we reckon that we could maybe have $1.5 million as an endowment, the William Black Fund for the education of African-American children in this town. When I met her, she was a professor in a university in a particular part of central Asu, and she had just finished that day making the third batch of dinners for 30 homeless people, 30 at a time, three times in the morning. They came to her church and she was in charge of feeding them. Well, that's what she has done for the kingdom of God. What will we do?
Gorgeous Greenbelters, John Bell. And John, on behalf of Greenbelt, can we just thank you, diolch o galon, a hearty thank you for all the years that you've given us. Thank you, John. Thank you. The stories which you've shared just amplified the theme for this year's Greenbelt, Hope in the Making. And I hope, like the conversation stories that John has shared, that you will also have maybe similar conversations over the weekend. Hope is a verb.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.